Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com, as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. Click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, YouTube, or basically any podcatcher that you listen to podcasts to. We're pretty much anywhere, and your listening is always appreciated. In addition to the podcast at the YouTube channel, you can also find quick takes, filmmaker reviews, and more. You can also check us out at patreon.com/SonicCinema. It's been a bit of a slow ride for that one in the past year, really. But I do want to get back to feeding that pretty regularly. And you do get early access reviews, film festival discussion, Oscar discussion coming next year, and more. That's going to be at patreon.com/SonicCinema. So our guest is somebody who you will no doubt know. He's been on the podcast, I don't even know how many times at this point. We always have a good time talking about horror, whether we like it or not. And you heard him earlier this year. He was the first episode of the year when we talked about Joseph Cotten. And you will be hearing more from him later in this year. But this time, we are going to pivot away from our original concept, which, honestly, as much as I like the concept, and we'll probably do it again at some, we'll probably do it at some point. I just was having a really hard time getting my head around it. We're going to do a little mini review episode for the 2024 adaptation of Stephen King's Salem's Lot. Joining me, as always, is Phil Faso. Phil, thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me, as always, Brian. And I think I was still in review mode from our last set, so I kept looking for Joseph Cotten to pop up in these Salem's Lot adaptations. Never found him once, though.
Would he have still been alive for the Tobe Hooper one?
I think he was. I think he was still around in 79.
Yeah.
And it's funny, because in that period, like in the mid to late 70s, you have a whole bunch of actors from that classic period, the 30s, 40s, 50s, Arthur Kennedy, Burgess Meredith, those type actors showing up in horror movies. And, you know, they were, I guess, what you would say, well past their prime at that point. But a lot of these actors had second careers, and Joseph Cotten was one of them. Raymond Land was in Frogs. I mean, Raymond Land is not the kind of guy you think would be in Frogs, but he's there. And these guys made second careers out of being in these horror movies. So to a whole new generation who hadn't grown up with stuff like, you know, Burgess Meredith either in Batman or even a little earlier in Mice and Men and those sorts of things, those guys just revived their careers doing those horror type movies.
Right. Well, and I mean, also you've got to think it's also a way for them to make a paycheck and to, you know, stay active in the Screen Actors Guild. Like, actors are constantly taking on projects. And so, I mean, yeah, I mean, you see that even now, where it's like actors will essentially, you'll find some actors in the strangest places. So, but yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, I do kind of remember him now being, yeah, he definitely would have been around, for the time of Tobe Hooper's adaptation of Salem's Lot in 1979. And yeah, so this was, so I mean, I will admit, like, this particular adaptation is my introduction to the story of Salem's Lot. I've never read King's book. I actually have not seen either the Tobe Hooper 1979 miniseries or the 2004 miniseries. But so we are going to, so what I want to start with, you're definitely more familiar with this material than I am. why don't you set the stage for us with what we're getting out of this material?
Okay, so my experience is the exact opposite of yours. I was 7 years old when the 79 miniseries was on television the first time in the two parts. And I actually watched it live. I probably was a little too young for that. And it scared the hell out of me. And I got to admit, like, people say it's dated, it's this. Or some people say Barlow looks cheesy in it. That film, every time I watch it, I watched it about 6 months ago. And every time I watch that film today, I get the same chills that I got when I was a kid. Now, maybe that's the immediacy of having seen it at that point, but it still works for me.
Yeah.
So my next experience was with the novel, because I had I was upstate for a summer, I think, and one of my grandmother's neighbors had the novel. And, you know, she knew I was an avid reader. She had a couple King novels, so I borrowed that one. And I was, I guess, terrified is a perfect word for it. You know, I'm in an isolated location upstate, not many townspeople, and here's this tale of a vampire and entering a small town and basically infecting everyone. And it's amazing because the book is much, much different from the movie, even with 3 hours and the script that they had for Tobe Hooper. A lot of characters get compressed, stuff gets cut. There is a whole scene in the novel and a whole chapter in the novel, and it's a long one where you basically meet, it's got to be 25, 30 characters, because that was King's first time, and he's done it a couple times since, where he's giving you basically an entire town. And to dedicate that type of number of characters to a movie, even 3 hours, would have been impossible. Like, had they done the streaming thing back in the day with the 8 to 10 episodes, I'm sure they would have gone that route in 79. But I'm kind of glad they didn't. And we'll talk about some differences when we get to the 2024 version. So I've read the novel 3 times and taught it once, actually. So I have experience with the novel. I actually prefer, this is one of those rare occasions, I have 2 degrees in English, literature and language. And this is one of those rare episodes where I actually like the 79 version better than the novel.
Hmm.
King tends to be overly long. King tends to go off on tangents. I've always preferred King's short stories to his novels.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I started listening to an audiobook of Cujo the other day, and he just, like, the first hour and a half of it, you see the dog, like, once. And it's a movie about a rabid dog. I'm like, oh, my God. So it's actually one of those versions where the movie actually compresses a lot of stuff, cuts a lot of stuff down, cuts some scenes out, switches some stuff with characters, and it works.
Yeah.
Then I watched the premiere in 79. I watched the premiere in 2004 of the Rob Lowe, I forget the name of the director, Michael Solomon, I think his name is. I watched that version, and one of the worst watches I've ever had for a movie. Oh, my God, it's terrible. It is so bad. And the funny part of it is that it actually, out of the 3 versions, it's the one that sticks closest to what's going on in the novel.
Huh.
But it's all an argument for, hey, trueness to the book doesn't make a good movie at all. It's terrible. I actually got it for like $4 on Amazon. I bought it for $4 on Amazon Prime the other night because they're having a sale on horror movies this month.
Yeah.
For Halloween. So I watched it. I had to drop my sister off at the airport at like 4 in the morning. And I'm like, oh my God, it's like midnight, 1 o'clock. I got to, it doesn't make any sense for me to go to bed now. So I watched it through the full thing, beginning to end. And as I get older, I find it hard to watch movies, longer movies, anything over 2 hours in one sitting normally. But I'm like, I'm going to sit down and dedicate myself. And basically, I'm going to punish myself by watching this. Which is great, because I never have to watch it again now. It was a worthy $4 investment. And that brings us up to the current version, which is fairly screen accurate. We can get into some of that stuff, because I have experience with the other ones. Now, did you just get hooked on this new one because of the, like, is it because of the whole backstory with what was going on the last 3, 4, 5 years with it? Or were you interested in it to begin with? Like, how did you get interested in this?
I wouldn't wouldn't necessarily say it was anything in particular that got me hooked on it. It just seemed like a good, it seemed like a good discussion point because A, it did just come out recently. I mean, I obviously, as somebody who does follow movie news, you do definitely, you know, you do definitely start to pay attention to the development of movies, especially movies nowadays where sometimes it'll get made many, many years before, and for some reason it'll take its time to get to release. And I mean, that was certainly part of it. And, I mean, you know, I've definitely, especially following all of the upheaval Warner Brothers in the past few years since it became Warner Brothers Discovery, since David Zaslav took over. I mean, I think like any, at this point, any of those movies that make it to audiences' eyes, whether it's on HBO Max or whether it's theatrically, I think is a benefit. And I mean, you know, I'm nominally just as a viewer of, just as a movie watcher, I would say I'm nominally a Stephen King fan. Like I've watched enough of his adaptations of his work at this point where, you know, I can definitely say I'm a fan of the stories that Stephen King tells through these films, you know, whether it's It, whether it's The Shining, whether it's Carrie, whether it is
The Rage Carrie too.
I mean, we talked about that. I mean, there are some interesting things that I think the past few years have started to really, I do think there are things in that movie that hold up better than you would expect. But yeah, I mean, I think as far as I'm interested in new adaptations of his work, The Mist is another great example. And obviously Darabont's adaptations of his work were always intriguing as well. True. You know, and then, so the director on this one, Gary Dauberman, he also adapted the novel for this film. He has a fairly, I mean, I don't know that I would necessarily say impressive run of horror credits for the past decade, but like he was basically involved in, worked on the Annabelle trilogy from the Conjuring universe. He did the Nun movies, or at least he wrote the first Nun. He didn't write the second one. And then he did do the adaptation, the two-part. He did do the screenplay for the
It.
The two-film adaptation of It, which I absolutely love. And, it is funny because of the fact that, I mean, you know, you were talking about fealty to the novel and, you know, the way that King handles things. And it's funny because of the fact that, I mean, it, I think, is a good, one of the things that's kind of interesting about King's work, I mean, I know part of this is him sort of taking control of some of the material when he hasn't been terribly pleased with the way filmmakers have approached it. I mean, obviously The Shining is the best example where he wasn't happy with Kubrick's film. So he shepherded the Mick Garris miniseries in the 90s.
Which is also absolutely awful, by the way. I don't know. Have you seen the 97 Shining?
I have. Yeah, and I have seen it. I mean, I'm definitely intrigued by it, by how it, the way, different ways it adapts it. But it's like I love Steven Weber. I love Rebecca De Mornay as presences. They just don't work for that material. Like, I mean, I know what they were going for. They were, again, it was more true to what King had in mind for the book, you know, because he didn't like that Jack Nicholson basically is Jack Nicholson from the time the movie starts. And yeah, but, you know, I mean, I know Carrie also had, didn't that a miniseries too, didn't it?
I think it was a TV movie. I don't think that one was a full movie.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I think you're right. It was a TV movie.
That one's weird because that one. So I read most of King's early stuff, and that one, that novel is set up as it's like a newspaper articles, but it's mostly a series of interviews with police and its characters telling what happened. And that particular version of Carrie, the TV version, there has the same format, so it cleaves a little closer to the book. But again, true to the source material, doesn't make it better than De Palma's movie by any means.
Yeah. And then, of course, we got another adaptation of Carrie a decade ago, which I was really looking forward to because I love Kimberly Pierce as a filmmaker. She did Boys Don't Cry. She did Stop Loss, both of which are terrific. But it just did not hit the mark. And
no, it misses by a wide margin.
It's like, how do you, like, there's so much potential for modern update of that story. How do you miss it that much? But going back to Salem's Lot, and I mean, I think the thing that is, I always knew this was a vampire story. The thing that one of the things that really struck me so much is how the introduction to this story really does feel like King doing his own riff on Dracula and Nosferatu.
Well, that's exactly what, well, not Nosferatu, we'll get to that in a minute, but that's exactly what King was doing.
Yeah.
King was teaching Dracula to, I think he was at a college, he was teaching a night class, I think, while he was writing, and he was teaching Dracula, and he came up with the idea, what if Dracula, instead of coming to London, came to a small town in America? And now you have the vampire transposed to America, and it's this little town with all these little, looks fine on the, you know, overview.
Yeah.
But if you dig a little deeper into the underbelly, you start to see the seams, and once Barlow comes in, everything falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's exactly what King was intending.
Yeah.
And it's funny that you mentioned the Warner Bros. Well, you can't really get around the thing that this movie was put off like 2, 3, 4 years or whatever it was. But I kind of find it funny that if you look at David Zaslav, okay, he's an evil entity who came into a place and started picking off its members. Sound familiar at all? He's essentially Warner Brothers Barlow. There you go.
Are you saying this was an unintentional unintentional riff on David Zaslav is doing at Warner Brothers Discovery?
Hey, if the shoe fits, right?
I mean, hey, you know what? We're never gonna see Batgirl. It looks like we're never seeing Coyote versus Acme. You know, I don't mind considering him a vampire because let's face it, that's basically what he's doing at this point with Warner Brothers Legacy, and it's honestly sickening. But you know, and then I like that setup. I do like the idea where, well, what if Dracula came to America as opposed to Europe? And I mean, it's an interesting setup. I mean, you know, he finds his way into the mythology. That's really nice. You know, part of the reason I mentioned Nosferatu is that I know we just talked about Dracula last year, but I'm so much more familiar with Nosferatu than I am any of the other adaptations of Dracula. That's naturally where my head goes. But I mean, the opening, the very opening scene where he, where Barlow's minions essentially, like, he gets the Marsden house. And so, I mean, and it feels very much in the same way that Hooter sent to Transylvania to bring Barlow to town. And, oh yeah, give him that house. Give him that house. That's kind of what I was thinking of. But, yeah, obviously it's Dracula as well. The thing that I, and then of course we get the writer's stand-in, Ben Mears, who, you know, it's a tradition, it's an author tradition like no other, the main character being a writer, and a horror writer coming back to his hometown. And, you know, he basically, he along with some of the other people in town start to uncover the mystery of what's happening in this town. And as you alluded to earlier, Vampire Barlow is essentially starting to turn the town into vampires.
Yes. So here's where my issues with this, and let me just give you my opinion of this first. I thought it was fine.
Yeah.
I thought Salem's Lot 2024 was fine. I didn't think it was spectacular. It's not something that's going to, you know, be on my every Halloween list every year.
Mm-hmm.
But it was good. Yeah. And I don't see, like, other than the politics of things, you know, this probably should have been in theaters a couple of years ago. And it probably would have done decently around Halloween time, I would think, you know.
Yeah.
Especially when you're touting the writer of the It's and, you know, director of Annabelle, whatever, blah, blah, blah. That type of stuff. But here's the problem, okay? There's a thing in video games called speedruns, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you take a game that it would take a normal person 24 hours to finish or 30 hours to finish, and you're going to go on a speedrun and you're going to finish that game, and there's tons of these on YouTube that you can watch.
Oh, yeah.
Where you run through the game in 8 hours or 9 hours or 7.5 hours because it's a speedrun, and the whole thing is just get through it as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's my problem with this adaptation, okay?
Yeah.
This is speed run through the source material. It's a speed run through the story, and there's a whole bunch of issues with that. It starts off, so I watched a ton of reviews of this thing after it came out, and unfortunately, I was in San. Well, not unfortunately, I wasn't unfortunate to be in San Diego last week. I was very happy to be there, but because I was out of town last week, I wasn't able to watch this the night it came on, because I'd seen the other two on their premiere, and I kind of wanted to do that.
Yeah.
So I watched it instead the night I got home, right? Mm-hmm. Sat through it. And so I watched a bunch of reviews of this the next day and the next couple of days, and someone pointed out in one of these reviews that the opening scene where Straker has these two guys go to get the, basically, it's a box.
Yeah.
And it's got Barlow inside. That happens 53 minutes in to the Tobey Hooper version. It's the opening scene here.
Yeah.
Right? And then the whole thing is, so both the versions, both the earlier versions, push off Barlow. You don't see Barlow till way in 79 to 2004. Okay? You see a glimpse of him within the first 5 minutes here.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So they're already pushing this and saying, we need to get through it. Now, I've heard that there is a much longer cut of this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they didn't, like, it really worked for Dauberman as far as the screenwriter goes in being a two-part. So this had enough material to do exactly that, especially because both the early versions were two-parters on television. So even if this was going to be released theatrically, you could have gone the whole, hey, we're going to split this in two. And because of the goodwill that Dauberman has from it, I'm sure people would have been willing to wait for the second part. I'm pretty positive that would have been the case. Okay? But the thing is, because he's now limited and he's got to bring this thing in, I think it's just under 2 hours. It's like an hour and 53 or 4 before the credits hit.
Yeah.
He now has to condense all this material into less than 2 hours. And it's such a speed rush through things. The characters make decisions that all of a sudden they jump to, like, there's no time to build things.
Yeah.
So The 2004 version spends a lot more time building the town. Like I said, it's got a million more characters than 79. Mm-hmm. But it establishes some characters, establishes what they are, what their motivations are. Takes time to build. The 79 version doesn't have nearly as many characters, and it's funny because that one used to get short shrift because people would say, oh, you know what? There's too much condensed here, right? Too much going. Now people are revering that for having so much depth and this new one being a speed run. So
yeah,
the issue here is that I really think this would have benefited from a 3-hour version. Mm-hmm. You would have more time to build things up. Like there's a scene when Ben and Susan are, I guess, on the quote-unquote first date when they meet at the drive-thru. And this is such shorthand screenwriting. She's like, oh, there's a lot going on in this town. And she starts pointing at cars, and this guy is a drunk, and this guy in this car is cheating on his wife, and she's doing this over here, and she had this, and he had this. It's shorthand for stuff that we really could have shown that would have given me a better appreciation for what's going on in this town. This right. doesn't really feel like a town. Everyone's – and the look is great. I think the look – the cinematography is awesome. I'm very impressed with the way they made it look like the 70s. But I'm not getting the feeling that this is a tight-knit community with 1,000 people in it. Yeah. I'm getting the feeling that this is 8 people in this town and a bunch of extras who live here, right? So, I mean, my main problem with it is exactly that, it's too condensed. There's way too much, and it rushes through things. I don't know how you feel about it because you're coming to this for the first time. So
right. When you're talking about it, though, I mean – It just, as a story, has a natural cutting off point, right? Because, yeah. I mean, it's got, you know, you're going to have half the story with them as kids, half the story with them as adults having to come back to Derry. So, I mean, that's a natural two-parter. I think, I will admit, I got really annoyed by the impulse to split movies into split books into two that happened in the early 2010s with Harry Potter, with Twilight, with Hunger Games, where even if it made sense, it's like, we know the only reason you're doing this is to make more money. I think 3-hour movies, I mean, even with the Stephen King pedigree name on this, even with the story being as familiar as it is, I do almost wonder if a 3-hour movie would have been really an easy sell for this particular story, because they had already had 2 other miniseries that were 3 hours, and especially if you're going to try to do it theatrically, 3-hour horror movies are rare. Like they're no, exceedingly true. Rare. I mean, granted, we got 2 that were nearly 3 hours in It Chapter 2 and Dr. Sleep in 2019, but I mean, It Chapter 2 was the follow-up to It, which was a monster hit. And then Dr. Sleep was nominally a sequel to The Shining. So, it's one of those things where it's like, I do think, as much I'm all for letting this story breathe, because you can tell this feels like the Cliff Notes. If you're going to go with another metaphor, I love the idea of the speed through. That actually makes a lot of sense, because yes, I mean, I'm familiar with those videos, but yeah, I mean, this to a certain extent does feel like a speed through of the material, and you can kind of tell that. And So it's one of those things where trying to give me...
You're trying to jam 8 pounds of horror into a 5-pound bag in this movie.
Yeah.
Another metaphor.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a quick question here. Okay. Given streaming now and how it's changed the way we look at stories,
mm-hmm.
could you have done this as, let's say, a 6-part streaming, quote unquote miniseries, epic event, whatever you want to call it, as opposed to a 2-hour movie? Do you think that would have worked?
Maybe. That's entirely possible.
I'm just trying to figure a way to make this story work.
Yeah.
Because the problem is that this is a rush job, and it's a shame because it's great source material. It's been done twice to different effect.
Yeah.
As far as, quality goes. But if you're going to invest in making this story, I don't see why you'd make it this way. And, obviously, you have masters that you need to serve at Warner Brothers Discovery, and, you decide that you can... I mean, the fact that this thing came out on its own is just... It's great that it actually made it out, right? And I understand why they did it the way they did it. But having seen more fleshed out versions twice with more room to breathe, it's just there's no way that this particular condensed version of this was going to satisfy me. And I don't know, I've seen a mixed, it has been a grab bag. I watched a ton of reviews of this thing last week. And, some people are satisfied with it. Some people are a little, that it's not fully fleshed out. And, you get a whole grab bag of opinions across the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, for me personally, having seen the 79 on the 2004 version, this one just falls flat on execution as far as compressing way too much.
Yeah.
Condensing things and just saying, all right, well, we have 2 hours. Here's what we can do within 2 hours.
No, and I think that's completely fair. I do think that's completely fair. I mean, miniseries, I can see that. Like I said, I can see that working. It's weird because of the fact that we don't necessarily have the 2-part miniseries now. I mean, everything's either 4 to 6, 8 episodes now.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, it's frustrating as hell because of the fact that it's like, so is that a full season of TV or what are we doing? I will say one of the things that you liked about the movie is something I very much like too. I'm a huge fan of the look of this film. I think the look of this film, the sound of this film, I think the cinematography, the production design, the cinematography by Michael Burgess, production design, and then the music, both the use of songs as well as the score, I think is really effective in this film. And I think they do a good job with it. And I think they do a good job of saying tone in this movie. I think that's where this movie excels. And the characters, there are some characters that are more engaging than others, obviously. And I think in that way, this movie definitely could benefit by being longer. I'm just not sure, it's hard to figure out the structure of this. What the structure would look like this if it wasn't a 2-hour movie in the modern era.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what we have then. Right? Let's talk about what we have as far as the movie goes.
Yeah.
So what particularly, you just mentioned some things that you like. What particularly did you like about the way the story was presented, the characters? Like you said, some are better than others. Like, what kind of things did you enjoy in this?
I do think as much as it does feel like it's rushing through things, I do actually like the structure of this film. In terms of, I do like the idea of starting with Barlow in town, and then, you know, Ben comes in town almost concurrently, and those two elements just start to work within the town in general. I mean, you know, Lewis Pullman is Ben Mears. I mean, he's fine. I mean, he's decent, but I mean, certainly not terribly memorable. I mean, I think both of us kind of agreed, like, Alfre Woodard as Dr. Cody is by far the most entertaining performance in this movie.
I don't know why you hire an actress like that who's got a ton of credits. She's been in some important movies, some Oscar-winning stuff, and you choose to make her the comic relief. Like, first off, Salem's Lot is one of those stories that doesn't need comic relief.
No.
It's really dark. Like, the idea that a whole town is being taken down by a vampire is pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
And some of the lines that they give her and the way that Dauberman, I guess, directed her to deliver those lines, I'm like, oh my God, why? Like, this is just so unnecessary. And I generally like her in a whole bunch of stuff. She's a great actress.
Oh, yeah, she's fantastic.
I question why you'd want her to be the comic relief if you need comic relief at all, which, right, I would argue you don't.
Yeah.
Now, what do you think about the kid that played Mark? Because everyone's going nuts about that kid. They're like, oh, great performance, this and that, blah, blah, blah. He's awesome.
I think he was decent. I think he kept my interest in the character. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, it's like, obviously we've seen, you know, King certainly has a propensity for putting kids in challenging supernatural situations. And I think this is in the tradition of that. I mean, I'm not going to say it's a great performance, but he might be one of the more interesting characters in the movie. I think he's certainly more interesting than Ben is.
Oh, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they chose Pullman because Pullman has that everyman quality to him.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
Especially in this movie. Like in Top Gun Maverick, he's the one guy who doesn't have the fancy name. He's just Steve or whatever it is, yeah, you know? So I think they definitely chose him for that. And he fits in that, but like you said, I mean, he's just kind of unassuming. Like, there's nothing exciting about him. Like, I can't picture Pullman as the guy leading a revolution against vampires, you know?
Yeah.
And again, he's fine. You know, I don't mind him. Mark Petrie, the kid who played him, fine. I don't understand why everyone else thinks this is some standout performance, but, you know.
I wouldn't go that far.
You know, Bill Camp, who plays Matt Burke, he's good in it. Mm-hmm. I like him.
Yeah.
Not really impressed with the girl who plays Susan. She's just kind of there.
Yeah. Yeah, Mackenzie Lee. I mean, she didn't really do much. I mean, obviously, she's basically the potential romantic interest for Ben, but it's like, yeah, it didn't really, like, when she turns later in the movie, it doesn't really impact us the way it should.
Well, that's also part of the thing with the whole rush job here. So let's take a look at this, right? First off, her introductory scene is her working at the front desk of Larry Crockett. Larry Crockett's the real estate guy in Salem's Lot.
Yeah.
Has a much bigger part in the novel. He lays the groundwork for Straker to buy the property and to come in to Salem's Lot and bring Barlow with him.
Mm-hmm.
They compress him with another character, so he doesn't have quite the same story in the first one. And in the 20, 04 version, same thing. He's got basically the same plot as the novel. And there's a huge part of that 2004 version unnecessarily, I think. But here, so she's at his desk, and I'm pretty sure she had her working that job just to get Larry Crockett in there, because he talks to Ben for like a minute, and then you never see Larry Crockett.
Yeah.
Right? So then her thing is, okay, well, she's reading the novel, and the whole joke is that she's reading his novel, Ben Mears novel.
Yeah.
But she doesn't know it's him, even though his picture's on the back cover. So there's that. So she's like, oh, I'm going to go to the drive-thru. She says something. I don't know if she mentioned the drive-thru there, but then she's at the library with her mother when he's doing research. Ben's doing research on the lot because there was a huge fire that wiped out the West End. And then his parents died in a car accident. And he's looking up stuff on microfiche, which I'm sure is going to confuse any modern kid who's watching this, because they're going to be like, why didn't you just Google this stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So they meet at the drive-thru, and then I think there's one other scene before we get into the vampire stuff where the lady who runs a boarding house comes to his door, and when Ben moved into the boarding house, she specifically said no guests. And then she says hello to Susan through the door, and you see Susan's got like a bra on. So it intimates that they were sleeping together. So they've had like three short scenes together, and then I'm supposed to believe that this is this great romance that is going to greatly affect him when she gets turned into a vampire. Mm-hmm. So, again, it just doesn't have time to build that relationship. And I think that part of the problem is neither one of those characters is exactly lighting the screen on fire when they're together either.
Yeah.
So, like you said, it falls flat. It falls flat for me, too. It just, this should have been fleshed out a little. And then they actually change some stuff to give Susan more screen time. And even that doesn't really build anything. Like, she's just kind of there, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I agree with that. Most of what I like in here is the visual aspects of the movie. I think Dauberman does a really great job with the images of the movie. I mean, you know, he sets up the story, I think, as best you can. But to your point, I mean, there's not depth to this. I mean, there really isn't. This is almost, you know, it's weird because of the fact that it's almost a... He was almost more interested in making this for the period piece aspects of this story than telling like a narrative with characters and stuff like that. And I mean, it's fine the way it is, but you know, I think it's, yeah, you do definitely tell that there's a lot of stuff that's missing from this story.
So let's talk about what really any vampire movie is going to come down to. How do you feel about the vampires?
I like the look of them. I like the, you know, the idea of the crosses glowing when they're around is a silly idea, but it's kind of fun, and it goes with the visual aesthetic of the movie, I think. Barlow is dull in this movie. Like, he makes no impression on me whatsoever in this movie. Like, it's one of my least favorite vampires in movies, honestly. Like, it goes back, like, my least favorite vampire in a movie, you know, or my least interesting, well, no, my least favorite performance by a vampire in a movie is the guy who played Dracula in Van Helsing. That performance was absolutely atrocious. The problem with Barlow, the problem with Alexander Ward as Barlow in this is that he just doesn't make any impression whatsoever. He's not seductive. He's not interesting. It's just like, okay, all right.
So here's what interests me about this. Okay. So the one of the criticisms of the 79 version is that in the novel, basically, Barlow is Dracula. He's very suave. Yeah. He speaks. Yeah. He talks. He's very seductive. He seduces these small town people into believing that he's going to do something better for them when he's really, you know, turning them into monsters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So one of the biggest criticisms at the time of the 79 version was, you just took this character and you made him into Nosferatu, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, as a selling point for a 70-year-old kid, you see something like that on screen, it's terrifying, right?
Yeah.
So the 2004 version with Rob Lowe hires Rutger Hauer to play him, and that cleaves closer to the novel. He speaks. He's not in it as much as he's in the novel, but he's in. You see a couple scenes with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he speaks. I mean, it's not one of Rutger Hauer's better performances. I think he was cashing in. Cashing a paycheck at that point.
Right.
But, you know, you have Rutger Hauer, you have a presence there. Okay. Yeah. This new one, so they tried to go for the, and I read an interview with Dauberman somewhere. He was like, yeah, well, we had a choice to make, and, you know, it was a novel, blah, blah, blah. But we really wanted to just go for a terrifying vampire in the old school way, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think this Barlow is particularly terrifying or convincing at all.
Mm-hmm.
And someone in one of those many reviews I watched after I watched it when I got home from San Diego said something that I can't get out of my mind now because every time I look at him, I see it. If you take the nun from the Nun movies and remove her habit, that's Barlow.
Yeah.
Barlow looks exactly like the nun without the nun outfit on. And then Straker is a weird one in this movie, Brian. I don't know what's going on with that guy's performance because he's in a whole different movie from everybody else. Mm-hmm. What's his name? I can't pronounce his name. I can't remember his name right now. But I'm like, oh my God, Straker is certainly different in this one. And I don't get him exactly that performance. But again, Straker is not even in that much to affect that much.
Right.
As far as the rest of the vampires go, I think it was a good look.
Yeah.
I think that they look creepy. They're terrifying. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's a pretty they did some good stuff with that, as far as they go. So they're actually scarier than Barlow, and I've never had that idea in a vampire in a Salem Lot piece before.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird. But all right, so do you want to talk about the climax? Do you want to get into spoilers? Because I have some thoughts.
I mean, the movie's been out for a week, so yeah, we can go ahead and get into spoilers.
All right, so I'm just going to give you the background on where the climax takes in the other version of this, and then we can talk about how it changes and what it does here. So I always liked the 79 version best because they build up the Marston House. And it's all about the Marston House, and it's all about the terror at the top of the hill, the house, the evil house looking over the town. So the climax with Barlow and Ben and Mark Petrie takes place in the Marston House.
Right.
I didn't realize until years later when I read the novel that they kind of spoil the Marston House for him. They put garlic all over the place and crosses so he can't come back in there. So it takes place in Eva Miller's boarding house. He's hiding out under there. And I thought that actually the movie did a better job because it's all about this Marston House. You have that built up. Why wouldn't you use that for your climax, right?
Yeah.
The 2004 version goes back to the novel and uses Eva Miller's boarding house basement, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this version goes somewhere totally different and decides to use a drive-in theater as the climactic location for what's going on here.
Yeah.
So I want to get your thoughts first because I'm really curious to see what you thought about it.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I'm not going to lie. I like the idea of everybody just sleeping in the cars and stuff like that in the trunks of the cars. And then they have to stay in the light, and then the light always constantly moving between the screen, between the forest, between in the trees and all that stuff. I actually dug that. I like that. I mean, does it make any lick of sense in the context of anything the movie set up before? No. I just enjoyed it. I did.
I applaud them for doing something different, and I kind of liked it as a different take.
Yeah.
I did. I don't understand how the movie makers didn't understand the idea, the difference between nighttime and a shadow, because just because they're in the shadow of the screen doesn't mean it's nighttime when there's sun all over the place outside of the shadow of the screen. And then once they start to get into the action with this thing, this is the fastest moving sundown in the history of the planet, Brian. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I enjoyed it because, you know, it was something different. I like the idea of them sleeping in the trunks. I thought that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a different take. And when they all went on fire, I mean, it's different. I didn't mind that. It was kind of cool.
Yeah.
And I thought that, you know what, if you're going to do something, you're going to put your stamp on it, that's a good place to put your stamp on it. This is the finale. Have it at a drive-thru. We've never seen that before.
Right.
You know, do something different with it. Make it your film. I didn't mind that. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
I think Barlow gets dispatched way too easily.
Yeah. Yeah.
Out of his coffin at that point. And I think that stabbing him through the back of the head was just so you could have that cool visual of looking through his skull, basically, to see Ben Mears with a stake in the back.
Yeah.
I think they dispatch him way too quickly for someone that's been around thousands of years, you know? What'd you feel about that? Yeah.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. Like I said, I mean, Barlow in this movie just really made no impression on me whatsoever. And yeah, I mean, that goes to it. I mean, I think for... You know, I'm intrigued by the story in the way that King's using so many of these familiar elements of vampire lore and Dracula to his own designs. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean I think Dauberman's execution in this movie of those ideas is particularly strong. I do feel like this is a movie I feel like best experienced as a visual one, and as a use of music, as a use of images, and then don't necessarily think for anything more than that.
No, I can agree with that. Yeah. And, you know, as much as I've, you know, as much as I might sound down on it, I would say, if I were going to say recommend this or not, yeah, give it a watch.
Yeah.
It's a little less than 2 hours, so it's a quick watch. It's fun, you know. It's nothing that's going to change anybody's life, I don't think. I don't think it's going to drive people to start reading Stephen King or anything.
Oh, no,
but,
no.
You know, it's fine. It's what it is. It's fun. And, you know, for Halloween, not a bad watch.
Yeah. No, I mean, I that's exactly where I'm at. I mean, you know, look, there's always going to be plenty of worse horror movies out there. And, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, if you're a fan of King's material, I can see this being disappointing. If you're a fan of the Tobe Hooper movie, you know, miniseries, which I do want to watch now, you know, I can see it being disappointing. But yeah, I mean, if you just want if you want something you haven't watched dozens of times before during the month of October, you can do a lot worse.
100%, you know, and is it a great King adaptation? No.
Yeah.
Is it a speed run? Absolutely. But is it fun? Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
yeah, it's fun. It's fun to watch.
I mean, even when the characters don't necessarily register, I mean, I do think there's enough elements in this movie that are fun. I mean, I like the way that we just get past the fact that people just accept the reality that vampires exist. You know, there's not a lot of, oh my God, I can't believe that. But, you know, and no, I mean, like I said, I enjoyed that climax. You know, I love the visuals in this movie. I love the music in this movie. It you know, it's, again, it's fine. I think there are good moments in this. I think the first graveyard kill is good in this movie. I think the use of light and shadow in this movie is really good. But yeah, just don't necessarily anticipate, to your point, something that's going to change your life. I mean, it's just a solid horror movie from a filmmaker who knows how to make horror films. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of all of the Annabelle movies. The one he did direct, Annabelle Comes Home, is honestly my favorite of those three movies in the Annabelle series. So I mean, I think he does know how to make a decent film. So it's you know, it's continuation of that.
No, I totally agree. And you know what? I gotta say, the more eyes that get on this Salem's Lot movie, the more that it'll hopefully convince the evil forces that be that if you're gonna spend money and make movies, you might actually want to put them out for audiences to see, because a lot of work and a lot of craft. A lot of people work on movies, hundreds of people sometimes. And, you know, I can only imagine how devastating it would be to go through all that and then see your movie shit canned for tax purposes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Again, if we're going to look at the true evil entity here, I'm sure David Zaslav is a good feeling for Barlow. I want to lift this cover.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Phil, thank you very much for joining me on this episode.
My pleasure. It's always
a pleasure to talk to you. We'll get into a little bit more depth in our next conversation. We're going to have a lot more to talk about. But yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And, you know, it's good to get, because of your expanded familiarity with franchise over me, that definitely gave me a lot of insight into the original story by King, as well as the other miniseries going forward. So I appreciate that.
No, and I appreciated getting the point of view of someone who's watching this not having any experience with Salem's Lot before this. So I think the fun part of this for me was that coming at it from those two different angles, we kind of came to the same thoughts about it.
Yeah.
Along the same
time. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot to say about this movie, but I mean, again, check it out, give it a watch on Max. I mean, you know, and the thing is, it's like, the more movies get, you know, yeah, I mean, movies are going to fail, inevitably, but at the same time, the more movies like this that are just solid, you know, the more views they get, the more likely you are of getting more from this filmmaker, from this type of story. And that's always a good thing.
Absolutely. 100%. All righty. Tom, Brian, thank you again for having me. Always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Phil for joining me on the podcast. It's always good to talk to him and talk to him about horror. That is going to be it for this episode of the Sonic Cinema podcast. We've got more with horror and Phil Faso coming up for the rest of the year. There's going to be some special things about that. And that is, but yeah, check us out at patreon.com/sonic cinema, as well as wherever you listen to the podcast, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, again, wherever you listen to podcasts. But also check me out, as always, on www.sonic-cinema.com. Thank you very much.